Welcome, Mim. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Well, you describe English as the great sponge of other languages. Expand on that for us.
I think that English probably borrows, begs, and steals more from other languages than any other one. And it's I think it's a great attribute of the language. It's always been a language where other languages could permeate it, and it's, you know, it started way back from the days of the Angles and the Saxons and the Normans. And when the Normans came, then suddenly a lot of French terms came into our language, and we've just kind of continued that tradition. And certainly when the English came to America, they continued that tradition where they would borrow from the Native Americans for words that described things that they had never seen before or ever experienced before. So we are a good sponge, and I think it's one of the things that makes our regionalism so colorful.
Well, you published an abridged edition of Samuel Johnson's Dictionary of 1755. Tell us why that project.
The Johnson Dictionary was something that I first discovered when I was actually editing another book on language that referenced it. And I had never heard of it, which now, in retrospect, I can't believe that I hadn't heard of it. But when I did some research on it, I discovered that the Johnson Dictionary of 1755, although it was not the first dictionary of the English language, it was the first dictionary that made the English language accessible, the definitions accessible to more people. And it defined some of the everyday words and not just all of these very peculiar, strange words that would often go into dictionaries. And the Johnson Dictionary became the quote, Bible of dictionaries for years, not only in England, but also in the early days of America, when Jefferson was writing his Declaration of Independence. He was actually using an English dictionary, which I think is a wonderful irony.
And what year did Noah Webster, join the fray?
He got into it in the early 1800s. And, of course, Noah Webster wanted Americans to speak and to spell like Americans rather than like the English. And so we have him to thank for the fact that we spell color without a U, for instance, and that we do have, a number of the words in our language that were not in the American language that were not necessarily in the English language.
Well, in Wicked Good Words, you have sections on each part of the country, including Alaska and Hawaii. So did you spend months in each part of the country researching?
Well, I wish I could have spent months in each part of the country. I did spend months researching, though. And although I've been to many parts of the country that are covered in the book, I didn't get to all of them. So Alaska and Hawaii, I basically compiled from research and also from some people who I knew who had visited these places as well.
Mm-hmm. With TV as the mass medium, are regionalisms going to fade away?
I think that regionalisms have started to fade away, and probably a good test of that is if we talk to our grandparents or even our great-grandparents and realize that there are expressions that they use that we don't use anymore. We just don't hear them anymore. So I think that it's a lot of things. It's our mass media. It's also our mobility. You know, people in this country move around a lot. We still do that. But what I found encouraging was that there are still as many regionalisms as there are. And there were two things that I found amusing. When I was working on the book, if I asked someone to tell me something unusual or specific to your part of the world that you say, you get kind of the deer in the headlights. It's like, well, we don't say anything funny. And then when my book came out, all of a sudden people would say, well, did you include this and did you include that? And we've always said this and whatever. So I think there are still a lot of regional expressions that kind of bubble up in people once you get them going on it.
Yeah. Are regionalisms popping up in email and text messages?
I think it's hard in text messages. I think text messaging is its own language, quite honestly. It's a language of acronyms. And I think it would be hard to regionalize them, quite honestly. Especially, you know, some of the southern regionalisms are, you know, they're a little bit longer. To get the full appreciation of them. And email, I've done a lot of email and corresponded with a lot of people on email, and I've never experienced any of them using a regionalism. So I think it's a talking phenomenon. I think it's a conversational phenomenon, and that's a very good thing that we still have these quote old-fashioned conversations where we're actually using our voice and talking to one another.
How did you decide which terms to put in and which terms to omit?
That was very difficult, and it's difficult especially when you go to the Dictionary of American Regional English, which is the Bible on regionalisms, and it's 5 volumes, and so you realize that there are millions of regionalisms in the country. What I tried to do was to find terms that I could corroborate. If I found them in a book, I wanted to be able to find them in places on the web. I wanted to find people who use them. Not all of them, but most of them. I also looked at some of the older regionalisms, which have kind of faded away, but some of them are neat terms and maybe we want to bring back.
Like, tell us a few.
Well, for instance, in New England, probably a lot of people there would not know what a moon cusser was, even though it's very much a part of the maritime heritage of New England. And the moon cusser was the person who, actually it was the person who would go out on a stormy night and would shine a lantern as a way to confuse a ship so that the ship would think it was a lighthouse and would come in, would basically end up being grounded, and then the moon cussers would go and scavenge the ship. Hmm. But if the moon were out, if it were a full moon, then the captain of the ship could see that the light was bogus, and so that wouldn't happen.
Well, I think that your book is a great resource for writers who are writing convincing dialogues. What other books would you suggest aspiring writers resource for their dialogues?
For their dialogues.
Yeah.
You know, oddly enough, I don't know if it would, it's not going to give them dialogue per se, but I actually think it's worth a skim of a Johnson dictionary. And in one of the ways it's good is if a writer is, if what he or she is writing about is set in the 18th century, because a lot of the words had somewhat different meanings to them. And one of the things I discovered in publishing that abridged edition was that there are lawyers in constitutional law who still refer to Johnson's dictionary to see what certain words meant at the time that the Constitution was written. So I think that's quite interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to ask you, this particular show is called The Dog Days of Summer. Yeah. So talk about that Ozark expression, "that dog won't hunt."
That was one that I had heard some friends say to me for a number of years, and I just thought it was marvelous. And some of it, of course, I think you have to have a good accent to really kind of carry it off. But you know, dogs kind of have a lot of strong imagery, and that particular expression, "that dog won't hunt," we know that it's been around since at least the 1930s, and it's now, you hear it in a lot of parts of the South now, and it basically means this won't work. So, and then you'll hear the opposite too, you know, that dog will hunt, meaning, oh, this is a good thing, this will work for me.
I like it.
Yeah.
So what's your next project?
My next project is, I'm sure it's going to have something to do with words, because American / English words. I do think that our language is just a marvel of contradictions, and so that makes it a treasure trove in many ways. And I'm fascinated with the origins of words, because I think the origins tell you not just about the word, but they tell you about the time and they tell you about the people. So probably something along those lines.
All right. Mim, what's the favorite word you uncovered in your dictionary? And
that's a tough one, because there were so many. But the expression that I really liked was Sputnik grass.
All right, what's that?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, because I didn't know what it was either. It's a type of seaweed that the fisher people of Long Island, who are called the Bonnocks, christened in 1957, and it was, of course, because that was when Sputnik was all pervasive in the world. So it became known as Sputnik grass.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Bye, Mim.
Bye-bye.
Bye.